Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Roy Green Show podcast.
I want to begin with this. I had the opportunity, we actually did it over 2 days because of phone challenges, not ours, phone challenges at the other end. I had the opportunity to have a one-on-one interview with Pierre Poilievre, who's leading, of course, in national polling to become the prime minister with a significant majority government. So let's play that back for you. A lot of areas, a lot of issues we covered with Mr. Poilievre. Let's start with this. Mr. Poilievre, let's begin with the carbon tax increase scheduled for approximately 2 weeks from now, April 1st. Mr. Trudeau says in response to multiple premiers calling on him to postpone the increase that they're short-term thinkers and that his job is not to be popular. And you and the Conservative Party will force parliamentary votes on this issue this coming week. Do you have a chance of derailing the April 1st tax increase?
I believe we do, Roy. You know, after 8 years of Trudeau, everything costs more. 200 million people are lined up at a food bank. Some are having to jump into dumpsters in order to get a meal. I spoke to a food bank in St. John's just the other day where they say that their demand is up 45%. Canadians cannot afford to pay any more Trudeau taxes. So we've mounted a massive tax revolt to spike the hike and axe the tax.
Let me move to the GC strategies question. It's publicly presented by the Federal Auditor General as the poster child for an unsupervised and out-of-control federal government money-plundering business. And yet the owners of GC strategies claim it's the Auditor General who doesn't understand or appreciate the truth of their situation or how to conduct an audit. Your reaction to that?
Well, two things. Here are the facts. This app was supposed to cost $80,000. It cost $60 million. 76% of contractors admit they did no work. It's GC Strategies, according to the Auditor General, got $20 million for this project, even though they don't do IT work. So apparently they are just the middleman. They are a four-person company operating out of a headquarters in the basement of a cottage. And they're getting all this money when they admit they don't even do IT work. So, you know, I don't blame them, though. I blame Justin Trudeau. He's the guy we elect to manage our money. These guys are just taking advantage of an incompetent, careless, aloof, wasteful prime minister to stuff their pockets with the hard-earned money of Canadians. So, I mean, Justin Trudeau is not worth the cost, and we need to fire him and replace him with a common-sense government that will cut back on outside consultants and other bureaucratic waste so that we can bring home lower prices.
Mr. Poilievre, do you have any idea how prevalent making off with many millions of public dollars through questionable federal contract bidding really is, particularly given Ms. Hogan and her auditors were unable to find where all the ArriveCan app money trail leads to?
They don't know where the money went, and they don't even know how much was spent. The Auditor General says it's at least $60 million, but she doesn't know for sure because there's no paperwork. I don't know how you can spend $60 million without having a record of it. Like, would there not have been bank transfers and other electronic records of all of this money? This is a federal outside consulting. It is now the fastest growing industry in Canada. It's grown by 100% under Trudeau. We now spend $21 billion on outside consultants, almost as much as we spend on our entire military. It works out to $1,400 in taxes for every Canadian family just to pay for outside consultants. So we slash the spending on this overall contracting out and bring the money inside the government. We have the bureaucrats. They're getting paid. They're more numerous than ever. They should be able to do the work without outside consultants getting $2,000 or $3,000 a day per person to do it.
Let me come back to the issue of the carbon tax and the opportunity that you'll have as the Conservative Party forcing two parliamentary votes on the issue this coming week. You said you do have a chance of derailing the April 1st tax increase. How would you do that?
The same way as we got Trudeau to take the tax off of home heating, it's by pressuring his MPs. If members of the Liberal caucus bang on the doors of the PMO, then he'll have to back down and cancel this April 1st hike. So I'm telling Canadians, call your Liberal MP, tell them to tell Justin to spike the hike. Secondly, they should vote for my motions next week, which will seek to cancel the April Fool's Day tax hike. And if there's enough Liberals, the Democrats, maybe even Bloc Québec law members who break with their leadership and vote for my common sense conservative motion, that we can spike the hike until such time as I axe the tax altogether.
Mr. Poilievre, we have prominent economists becoming deeply worried about Canada's future, and investors are taking note, according to a Globe and Mail story. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development projects Canada's real per capita GDP growth will place us dead last as the worst performing advanced economy from 2020 to 2030. But the OECD isn't finished. They project Canada's economy will continue to be the worst performing among advanced economies until 2060. What will you do? What can you do should you be elected a majority government prime minister to take proper advantage of Canada's natural resource center and to increase the amount of oil and natural gas this country exports to a waiting and in need world?
So my common sense plan is to axe the tax, build the homes, fix the budget, and fire the gatekeepers. So we're going to axe the carbon tax, which will lower the cost of industrial production. It'll make our farms, factories, fisheries, and forestry all more competitive when the energy costs are down. Affordable, abundant energy is the pillar of economic growth. And we're going to have it by firing the gatekeepers so that we can speed up permits for mines, pipelines, oil and gas projects, and other resource production. We have the greatest resources per capita of any country in the world, but the worst approval laws. So I'll repeal C-69, the unconstitutional anti-development law of environmental fanatic Stéphane Guilbeault and Justin Trudeau, and we'll repeal that law, replace it with a law that gets things done in this country. We're also going to build the homes. Right now, residential real estate is sucking up so much of our investment because people are forced to spend all of their savings on inflated real estate. I'm going to get the government out of the way so we can build affordable homes by requiring municipalities permit 15% more home building per year as a condition of getting their federal dollars, by selling off 6,000 federal buildings and thousands of acres of federal land, and by eliminating the carbon taxes on home building materials. And finally, we're going to fix the budget by capping spending and cutting waste to balance the budget. We can bring down inflation and interest rates and make our dollars stronger and the economy more powerful. That's my common sense plan to leapfrog over the other countries and unleash growth in Canada.
Mr. Poilievre, let me come back to the carbon tax. BC Premier David Eby answered your letter to him asking Mr. Eby to support the majority of Canada's premiers and you by adding his name to the call by the premiers to halt plans for a carbon tax increase on the 1st of April. Mr. Eby accuses you of operating a baloney factory. What do you say?
Well, his constituents can't even afford to buy baloney after 8 years of him, the NDP, and Liberal coalition because housing costs have doubled. The carbon tax is quadrupling. Inflation is its worst in 40 years. That's his and Justin Trudeau's record. And now he wants to raise the tax another 23% and quadruple the tax over a four-and-a-half-year, five-year period. That is absolutely insane. So he should talk to his own citizens in British Columbia who can't afford to eat, heat, and house themselves, and join with the seven other premiers who called on Trudeau to spike this April 1st tax hike.
Melanie Jolie, the foreign minister, visited with the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, who really isn't the leader of Gaza. Hamas is the power in Gaza. Ms. Jolie, or Minister Jolie, had her picture publicly taken with Abbas, who has questioned the Holocaust and downplayed the Hamas brutality against Israeli citizens last October the 7th. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I think Trudeau has tried to divide Canadians on the Middle East to distract from his quadrupling carbon tax, his doubling of housing costs, the crime wave he unleashed with catch and release here at home. He's tried to divide Jews against Muslims and Canadian against Canadian. I think we need to stop that. We need to take a clear and consistent stance that the only way to have a peaceful end to this conflict is for Hamas to turn over the hostages, disarm, and unequivocally and unconditionally surrender so that October 7th type attacks never happen again.
So did I also just hear the answer to my question that I haven't asked about the NDP resolution to be voted on in Parliament on Monday, which calls for the recognition by the Canadian Parliament of a state of Palestine and the end of Canadian military equipment sales to Israel?
I will be voting against that because right now Hamas is still running Gaza. So you'd have Hamas as the head of state in Gaza, and I don't think we want that. So we need, I believe that we should have a Palestinian state, but it has to be a peaceful, democratic state, not controlled by terrorists.
Let me ask you about our justice system, which often appears to be neither justice nor system. Notorious prisoners, horrific murderers, Paul Bernardo, Luca Magnotta, transferred quietly to medium from maximum security prisons. And then, Mr. Poilievre, there's George Lovey, the killer of former Buffalo Sabres and Team Canada goaltender Don Edwards' parents. He was just granted full parole by just two members of the National Parole Board, and only days after Lovey went AWOL while on day parole. Don Edwards and his wife, Tanis, will be back on my program tomorrow. What do you say to the victims' families?
I hear you, and I understand your frustration. We must end the catch-and-release criminal justice system enacted in Trudeau's bill C-75, C-83, C-5 that bring automatic bail, quick early release for gun crimes and extortion, that allow house arrest for career car thieves. I'm going to repeal all of that. It's going to be jail and not bail for repeat violent offenders. No more house arrest or parole for dangerous offenders. We're going to keep the worst criminal murderers in maximum security penitentiaries. We're going to secure the borders and the ports against the illegal importation of drugs and guns. That's how we're going to bring home safety for our people and stop the crime.
And one more question for you. The issue is immigration. Canadians by majority are telling national pollsters they have concerns about the impact of Liberal Party immigration numbers and targets, which the worry among many Canadians is they're negatively impacting on housing, health care, and social programs. How would you approach immigration?
I would link the immigration numbers to the availability of housing, health care, and jobs. I'd end the false asylum claims and the illegal immigration by fixing the mess in the asylum program that basically allows people to come in with no evidence that they are real refugees, and then we spend 7 years trying to get them out of the country at enormous cost to our social safety net and our housing market. I would work with the provinces to set population growth so that it doesn't exceed the number of homes we build. We need to build homes faster than we bring in people, or else we're going to worsen the housing shortage. So it's common sense. Look, we had the best immigration system in the world before Justin Trudeau ruined it. I want to get back to that common sense system.
A massive jolt happened, and I was awakened, and I looked up to see the gentleman that was sitting next to me on the roof of the plane. I'm looking at him fully outstretched with his back on the roof of the plane, and then he came crashing down to the floor. It was insane. I was like, I thought I was dreaming. The plane basically stopped. Like, it almost, the best way to describe it is it's dropped out of the air instantly. And then it started to tail down, like nose down. And then it just picked up, it just kicked into gear and just took off again.
One passenger on a Boeing Dreamliner 787. That was on its way from Sydney, Australia, to Auckland, New Zealand. 50 passengers were injured as that plane just dropped out of the sky for a while, or dropped down, and passengers who weren't belted in were on the ceiling of the aircraft. 50 people injured. I think one or two had to go to hospital. There have been incidents over the last couple of weeks on Boeing 757s, that I was on to Switzerland and back, not the same planes. Well, I don't think so. Tire falling off seconds after takeoff from San Francisco. And the nose wheel of another Boeing 757 airliner broke away while it was taxiing toward takeoff at Atlanta International Airport in January. Tom, get that other clip up from the captains communicating with each other, because it's from this incident where the nose wheel of the Boeing 757 airliner broke away while it was taxiing. Play it.
Delta 982, this is the aircraft looking at you. One of your nose tires just came off. It just rolled off the runway behind you. Delta 982, tower, sounds like we've got a problem.
Yep, a big problem. You don't want your nose wheel tires falling off. You don't want your tires falling off your plane when you're 8 seconds after you've taken off. And then there were the tragic circumstances of the Boeing 737 MAX 8. Two of them crashed. Everyone on board died. The planes were taken out of service for about 20 months, just a couple of years ago. They're back in service now. And there have been incidents with with those planes, again, over the last couple of weeks. So the FAA is involved. I think there have been criminal charges laid, or at least criminal charges are being considered. And then there was the Boeing whistleblower who was found dead in the parking lot of his hotel a couple of days ago, John Barnett. He just basically finished his testimony against Boeing in the lawsuit. And this is from his testimony. When I first started working at Charleston, I was in charge of pushing back defects to our suppliers. What that meant was I'd take a group of inspectors and actually go to the supplier and inspect their product before they sent it in. I'd take a team of four inspectors to Spirit AeroSystems. That's a supplier for Boeing. They're now admitting that they were put in bolts, screwed in bolts, where they weren't supposed to be, to inspect 41 sections, the portion of the aircraft extending from the nose to just after the cockpit window. And before they sent it to Charleston, we found 300 defects on this one aircraft. He went on to say some of them were significant and needed engineering intervention. Door plug got blown out of the Air Alaska MAX 8 in January. And the saying used to be, as I said this before today, earlier today, saying used to be, if it's not Boeing, I'm not going. And now, apparently, it's become, if it's Boeing, I'm not going. This is a huge, huge issue, massive issue. So many of these planes are in service. And what is going on? So I reached out to our good friend, Captain Raymond Hall, former head of the Air Canada Pilots Association. He's a lawyer, multi-decade Air Canada captain who flew Boeing airliners on major international routes. Raymond, thank you for coming on. What is this information? Right. And I haven't mentioned all of them, but what does this say to you?
I think your last clip summed it up. We have a problem. We've definitely got a problem. From Boeing's perspective, things started to go south approximately 1997 when it acquired McDonnell Douglas aircraft, the manufacturers of the DC-9 and DC-10, MD-11 aircraft. There was a major corporate shift at that point in time, leading to the transfer of the headquarters of Boeing from Seattle to Chicago, and even more recently now from Chicago to Arlington, Virginia, across the river from Washington, D.C. The company executive was essentially taken over by the administrators of McDonnell Douglas, who were primarily accountants, MBAs, that sort of thing. The ostensible reason for it was to position the company as more than just an airliner manufacturer company. They had space technology and military technology, that sort of thing. But the result of it was a significant departure from the engineering management that had developed the history that led to that expression that you've used, and towards more corporate profits orientation and less inspections. Later, it was complicated, as we know from the 737 MAX, with the FAA essentially deregulating its components and having the inspectors sub-delegated within the Boeing company, so that essentially the fox was looking after the hen house, and a lot of things got away that shouldn't have gotten away. And it would appear that things are still going in that direction with the recent audits that have been done by the FAA of Boeing, numerous failures on inspections. But having said that, and I'm really troubled by the iteration that you have of these events, because it is really seriously concerning, and we do have a problem. But having said that, we do have to keep our perspective in the sense of flight safety over the course of the last several decades has increased substantially, notwithstanding these events, substantially. And it's still approximately 595 times safer to fly than it is to drive. So those are individual events, and nobody's happy with them. I'm certainly not comfortable responding to them. If I can expand a little bit more, there are four components, as I see it, to flight safety. One is the aircraft manufacturer. One is the aircraft maintenance. Then the pilot operations, including dealing with weather and difficult situations. And then there are other factors, more remote, such as exogenous factors like unruly passengers and aircraft getting shot down over Ukraine and Iran, for example. So as far as Boeing is concerned, it's primarily the manufacturing problem that is being addressed now. And in terms of the wheels falling off the airplane, the panels falling off perhaps as well, it is more than likely a maintenance problem. I know that Boeing 777 that lost its wheel in San Francisco had been in service for over 10 years, so it really isn't part of the aircraft design so much as the maintenance by the individual airlines. The flight safety is primarily increased as a result of the better technologies, the cockpit technology especially, the use of the autopilots by increasing augmentation of flight crews so there's less fatigue. And the statistics show it, that the number of accidents, the number of incidents are way, way down over what they were just even 10 years ago.
Raymond, I was on a 757 from Pearson Airport in Toronto to Zurich in December, came back on the 757. It was an incredibly smooth and comfortable flight. I had no concerns because at that point, I only really heard about the MAX 8 Yeah. And the 9's having problems.
It was a 787, Roy, that flies from Toronto to Zurich. But and that is a even more recent aircraft, of course, than the 757, and much higher technology there. But you're right about that.
It's a very fine line, isn't it? It's an extremely fine line when the stories get out, and there are multiple stories about one particular airplane manufacturer. People start to pay attention, and you know, when the whistleblower ostensibly committed suicide, although he told a friend that if he died, it wasn't going to be suicide. He mentioned that on a ABC network affiliate radio television station in Charleston. And his lawyer says, doesn't believe that he committed suicide. So there's a lot going on. So many wheels in motion. What impact does this have on the flying community, on pilots? If you're a pilot and you're assigned, and you have to be qualified to fly on the plane, of course, if you're assigned and qualified to 737 MAX 8, how do the crews feel about flying those now?
I've spoken, of course, I'm retired from Air Canada now. I've been away for a few years, but I fly quite regularly on Air Canada, and I've talked to the pilots, and they are completely satisfied that the changes that were taken after the 20-month absence have more than corrected the issues there. I think more it's now an issue for going forward with the manufacturing in the factory, that the senior management of Boeing really has to get back to the basics, away from the profit orientation and focus. You can't make a profit if you can't build an airplane that's safe. And so the focus has got to be put back onto the manufacturer itself and the processes. And I think the government has a very, very large role to play in that regard by ensuring that the inspections are done on an ongoing basis and thoroughly, so that these things just stop happening.
Yeah, it's not good when a passenger, and you and I have talked previously about privately and on the air about the fact that I'm an uneasy flyer. I don't really like being in aircraft. But so I'm not the most objective observer. But it's not good when I was in Orlando, I called Air Canada and said, can we get the flight changed to an Airbus? And it was possible, but they were going to charge us a hefty fee to make the change. But it was just the fact I saw a Boeing MAX 8, and my mind said, nope, got on the plane, we made it. I felt fortunate.
Well, if it's any consolation, Roy, I feel less comfortable in the back than in the driver's seat. Okay,
and yeah, that's true too, isn't it?
Yeah,
you're not in control.
But it's a minor, less minimal comfort. I have complete confidence in the aircraft, and I certainly have complete confidence in the crews with the training and the technology that's available right now. So it really comes down to numbers statistically. It's so remote that any particular person is going to have any kind of incident. And further, the incidents themselves are fairly minor. Now, having said that, I was tempted to joke about that fellow being, it sounded like one of my flights, but it really wasn't.
No.
It's a serious matter. Those are so remote, those circumstances, that I don't have any discomfort with getting on the aircraft.
Yeah, no, I understand the statistics, but the statistics mean nothing. The people on the aircraft that's having trouble, right? I mean, you get on the plane, you say, oh, it's more safe than driving to the airport in my car. But when the aircraft starts having trouble, those statistics literally go out the door plug that got blown out of the aircraft. It doesn't help when there's incident after incident after incident.
Right.
And the whistleblower says the quality control wasn't there. And when we told them there were problems with the quality control, they moved us off the line into another kind of job.
And they swept it under the carpet.
Yeah. The visuals are awful. How long do you think it would take for Boeing to reestablish its reputation to where it was when people would say, if it's not Boeing, I'm not going?
At least 2 years, probably closer to 5, because you're talking about a complete corporate attitude towards what you're doing, what you're building. You have to establish the confidence by numbers again. You have to get the inspections. You have to have the manager satisfied. You have to change the management itself into a form that has zero tolerance for this type of behavior. And that would take time.
Yeah, I take it you always had complete confidence when you got onto the flight deck when you sat in the left-hand seat.
Well, there's always instances. I mean, we have a thing called the minimum equipment list, which is the list of things that you have to have or you don't go. And quite often, we call them MEL items. And quite often, you get into situations where you're really questioning whether it's safe to go because of the MEL. The maintenance has signed it off and said, okay, you can go on for a little while. And I've had many circumstances where I had to actually call maintenance in. In some cases, say, no, I'm not going.
Yeah.
We're going to get this fixed right
okay.
now. This problem is deeper than what you're reporting here, and you're not going to shovel it off onto the next station. We're going to get this fixed, or we're not going to go.
We're going to axe the carbon tax, which will lower the cost of industrial production. It'll make our farms, factories, fisheries and forestry all more competitive when the energy costs are down. Affordable, abundant energy is the pillar of economic growth.
Yesterday, Mr. Polyev was in New Brunswick. He was on a backcountry road and the signal was so poor that we stopped the interview. We said we'd resume it today, which gave me an opportunity to ask Mr. Polyev about David Eby, British Columbia's premier, saying that what Polyev is saying about the carbon tax is from the bologna factory. And Mr. Polyev's response was, maybe you can find it, Tom.
Well, his constituents can't even afford to buy bologna.
As soon as I saw that line from David Eby, it's the bologna factory. I thought, you should never say that, because the first thing I'm going to come back with, if you're pointing at me, is probably that your constituents can't afford bologna. Okay, Globe and Mail headline, more economists are getting deeply worried about Canada's future and investors are taking notice. Earlier this month, Scotiabank's head of capital markets economics, Derek Holt, wrote, quote, "I'm deeply worried about public policy in my country," end quote. Over the last weekend, BMO chief economist Doug Porter and National Bank strategist Stéphane Marion joined the grim chorus. And then there's the OECD, which projects Canada's economic performance this decade, so through to 2030, and then through from 2030 to 2060, will be dead last among advanced nations. Meanwhile, as I said, and we've talked about so many times, among us, ourselves, and with Premiers Moe and Smith, we have what the world needs and is willing to purchase, namely natural resources such as oil and natural gas. And that makes me a really bad guy with some people, because I'm promoting that Canada should sell ethically produced oil and natural gas that the world is going to use anyway. So why don't we sell it? Maybe the Americans want to have an exclusive North American outlet, don't want us involved. Politics is a dirty game. But we had options. I'm not so sure how many we have now because of the regulatory issues that are in place. But Mr. Polyev also told us that he would take care of and get rid of a lot of the regulatory impediments to creating an export reality for oil and natural gas. You can do that, and you can pass it through Parliament. I didn't really have the time to get into it with him. But many of those initiatives, even if he gets them through Parliament, will be challenged, will go to court, and potentially to the Supreme Court of Canada, and that could take years. Professor Eric Kam is with us, our good friend, professor of macroeconomics at Toronto Metropolitan University. Professor Kam has been very direct about the condition of the economy of this country, very direct of where we stand, and unwaveringly challenging of the status quo. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Roy. I have to jump in and say something. It's so funny. Sometimes you just say things that hit so close to home. My 10-year-old is coming home from his March break vacation on Monday, and I went out today to buy bologna, because it's his favorite thing to put between two pieces of bread. And so help me God, I stood there looking dumbfounded at the grocery store going, that's how much a package of bologna is? I mean, this is pretty much you know, bargain basement lunch meat, probably one or two ingredients. And this is what they're asking for, a thing of bologna. It's so funny you said it, because I think it's so representative of what's going on right now at the grocery stores.
I had the same sort of experience. I was in the grocery store I frequent, and I wanted to buy some kielbasa. Because occasionally I like to eat kielbasa. I looked at the price of this little piece of sausage, and I said, you got to be kidding. Not going to happen. And I just kept on walking. Not that I can't afford it. But I looked at it and said, I'm not paying that.
If you and I can't afford some things at the grocery store, or even if it just causes us pause on something like bologna or kielbasa, what do you do if you're that average Canadian that is close to insolvency? What are you eating? What are you dressing your children in? How are you paying your rent? I mean, this is becoming so circular and almost, I hate to say the word, but almost boring, that you and I get together and we bemoan three certain facts that just are not changing over time. Our public sector is growing. Our private sector is shrinking. The government thinks immigration is a sound growth strategy. And from where this economist sits, it's three strikes, we're out, Roy.
I've been reading a brief email that I received from a listener. I tried to get the listener to come on the air. I sent him two emails. He didn't reply. So I'm calling him George. That's not his real name, but here's what he wrote. And he addressed this, by the way, Professor, to Jagmeet Singh, to Justin Trudeau, to Stephen Gilbo, Chrystia Freeland, and copied Pierre Poilievre and me. Honorable members, I've reached out many times before, but now we're pretty much caved in financially, even after I've been working almost 60 hours overtime a month just to keep my family warm this winter and eat $1 noodle cups. Stop the attack on the lower and middle class. Just stop it, please. I thought that Jagmeet was the voice in support of the working class. No longer. Please stop, stop, stop driving us into oblivion. Learn what it means to pump a tank of gas and go to a grocery store. You are horrible custodians of our country, and you should all be fired. Scrap the carbon tax on home eating everywhere. Absolutely disgusting. No sense of reality for everyday Canadians. That's the email.
You know what, Roy? His real name is, he's entitled to his privacy, but mine's Eric Cam, and I'm not hard to find. And I think that that is sage wisdom right there in a letter. I mean, no matter what macroeconomic variable we're looking at right now, there are just some things that are not deniable, things that the government cannot massage. And one of them, domestic productivity, as you mentioned, that is output per worker. That is the strength of our economy per person going to work. And it's fallen for the third annual consecutive year. And that's the first time that's happened in 40 years. So simply put, a country's ability to improve its standard of living over time depends entirely on its ability to raise output per worker. And now we're in our third, going into our fourth straight year that number has fallen. And I think that letter is actually very correct. I don't think Mr. Singh gives a damn about the average Canadian. I know our prime minister doesn't. And before somebody jumps in and says, well, how do you know that? You don't know the prime minister. All I can take is the evidence that I see in our country right now. I see just about every single macroeconomic variable at zero or trending down. I see still half of our mortgages need to be renegotiated at rates that were first negotiated around 1% to 2%. They're going to be now between 7% and 8%. I still see grocery store prices up around 23% from where they were during the pandemic. I mean, how much evidence does a government need to finally have somebody cry uncle and realize that Canadians need help? But this government is tone deaf. They are full speed ahead on their net zero green agenda, and it's befuddling to all economists. And now you see it's just becoming befuddling to all Canadians who are looking at elected people going, we elected you to help us. You're hurting us. Stop the madness, Roy.
And interestingly, one of our callers after our Pierre Poilievre interview pointed out that not only will the carbon tax rise on April the 1st, but MPs will all receive a raise.
Sure, because that's the way that this government rolls. I mean, let's bring in some more numbers to discuss our declining competitiveness. How about portfolio investment? Simple topic, right? Investing in our country. In 2023, we now have numbers. Canadians bought $53 billion in foreign securities. Foreign investors bought $32 billion of Canadian securities. That's the smallest number in 16 years. So what does that say in plain and simple English? It means the rest of the world are skeptical and tired of investing in a country that is a net loser. I mean, you know, again, and I'm so sad. I don't say this to hear the sound of my own voice or to scare people, but it's just time that we start doing something to help our nation. Put some growth drivers in place. Increase our disposable income. Can we please do something other than bring in things like dental care and pharmacare that are frankly good ideas in the right economic environment, horrific ideas in this type of economic environment? You can't do these things, which are so expensive, to the tune of more billions of dollars going out, Roy, unless the economy is booming. Our economy is not booming. Our economy is trending down. And it's time that we reverse the trend and start to follow. I know we're afraid of following the United States, Roy, but they did it after the pandemic, and now their economy is rising, slowly, but rising. Well, guess what? We're going down, and we're not going down slowly. We're going down steeply, and someone's got to stop the madness.
So to the younger generation that is going to have to live with the fact of our declining economic output, with the declining economic reality, according to the OECD, again, Canada being the last among developing or developed nations as far as success, economic success is concerned, until 2060. What's the prognostication? What's the view look like for young people about to begin a career?
It's actually really simple, and I can sum it up in one word: fear. Students are scared. I hear from my students all the time, Roy, that they are scared. And while I can list you many things, points of interest that I have, there is only for me a small silver lining, and it's very small, and it may not even be silver. But that if you look at the statistics of economic growth and countries that thrive since about 1900, one of the indisputable facts is that educated economies are growth economies. And so in one sense, it's easy for me right now to tell my students that if you want to live in a country that's going to thrive, one of the foundations is an educated workforce, and actually specifically a female educated workforce. If you look around at the world, countries that educate women are the strongest economic countries. And so I do have that in my back pocket. But to your point, they're terrified. They're terrified of the price of renting. When they've heard stories from parents and grandparents that renting used to be what you did to save for a home. Roy, now that's a pipe dream unless you have some family wealth behind you. So we're telling our students now that they're going to have to be mobile, and they're going to have to look around at centers of growth or potential growth if where you're living now isn't one of them. You may have to be willing to live outside an urban center. You know that you're going to have to probably live at home longer with your parents before home ownership. And I think most sadly for me, when students ask me on this topic of what scares them, will I match my parents' economic quality of life? On average right now, Roy, the answer is no. And so what I tell my students is, beside please study, because that is one tried and true way of success, the other one is to be loud and be informed and use your education and think about it when you step into a voter's booth. And be able to discern what is baloney from what is substantive. And I just wish that our public sector right now would take a lead in that model and showing that to our students. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I think the younger people are going to have to show the public sector how to do their jobs before they get voted out of doing their jobs, Roy.
In the 60 seconds we have, what's the absolutely essential thing that has to take place in order for our economy to even approach positive and stable footing?
Two things. Number one, we need to reduce taxes to increase disposable income. I would have said it's time to get our energy sector up and running, but sadly, Roy, it's probably with this government too little too late. And it's not going to happen. I don't dream that big. So I do dream about a world where they reduce taxes and people have more money to spend. Number two, Dear public sector, you don't do things well. You are inefficient. You are poor at running businesses as anything I've ever seen. Get out of business. Get out of healthcare. Get out of dental care. Get out of pharma care and turn things back to the private sector. The private sector isn't perfect, Roy, but it's better than the public sector. If you want to build highways, you go ahead. But please, please, public sector, get out of the business of business. You do it poorly and you're killing our nation.
Professor, I had a conversation with somebody the other day about healthcare. And I made the point about, as you just did, about private healthcare. And I got the big lecture about how terrible private healthcare could possibly be. And I said, do you ever pay attention to what's going on? People are dying in emergency rooms while they're waiting for health care. 5.6 million Canadians have no family doctor. Do you even pay attention to any of this? And that's where the conversation ended, because the person I was speaking with hung up. I want to play something for you. Okay, play it.
And long live freedom. Damn it.
The president of Argentina at the World Economic Forum. Long live freedom, damn it. Professor Cam, always a pleasure, always an honor. Thank you so much.
The honor is all mine, Roy. Stay healthy, please.
Practice, we work, reorder the thoughts. We worked with lobby Conflict of Interest Commissioner on a regular basis on a broad range of issues when the issues come up. On this issue of a family vacation with a personal friend, it wasn't considered that there would be an issue there.
It's just unbelievable. I looked at the video of Mr. Trudeau being quizzed about his trip to the Bahamas to see the Aga Khan. And then I listened to it and I thought, oh man, you know, and I know, and so does everybody else. I want you to hear it again.
The fact is, we work, reorder the thoughts. We worked with lobby Conflict of Interest Commissioner on a regular basis on a broad range of issues when the issues come up. On this issue of a family vacation with a personal friend, it wasn't considered that there would be an issue there.
Okay, whatever you say. The Ethics Commissioner did not agree and convicted Mr. Trudeau of a violation of the Conflict of Interest Act. If I can say it, how come he can't say it? Now, let's talk to a former Liberal Member of Parliament who was Mr. Trudeau's seatmate in opposition, and Michelle Simpson, who, of course, is a good friend of this program and a member of our Beauties and the Beast panel. And we've talked to Michelle in the past about the ethics situation, what she faced when she would not behave unethically. And she was punished for that. But it's something else that Michelle said to me a few days ago when I called her that really, it had me standing up, Michelle. And it's nice to talk to you. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
So when we talked a bit about what you told us in the past. I'll ask you to explain it again in a moment because many people may not have heard what your experience was, but when you were being coached in how to violate the ethics of Parliament and the rules of Parliament when it comes to discretionary spending or expense account spending, you weren't alone. You had a member of your family there with you, your husband, right?
Absolutely, because it was during orientation and they actually encouraged, you know, the spouses to attend so that they can, you know, hear and see for themselves what you can expect. So it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, so here we go, Michelle Simpson and all the new members of Parliament and your significant others. We're going to tell you how this thing works. And including that, and that is, we're going to coach you on how to break the rules and how to compromise ethics. I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
No, to kind of get, to circumvent, yeah, or, you know, nicely tippy-toe around the rules.
Oh, that's what they said, tippy-toe around them.
Yeah, yeah. With a nice smile.
Look, referees have whistles and flags, and I had enough contact in the world of sports to know that if you tippy toe around the rules, it doesn't make any difference whether you barge through them or tippy toe around them, you're still going to get called. What was your husband George's reaction when they got to the, and before we ask you about the details, what was his reaction when they started to coach you on how to circumvent the rules of the ethics?
Well, you have to understand his background, and he spent his career with a large Canadian bank. He was a vice president, and so he was used to rules, like very strict rules, and, you know, being audited and that type of thing, and his head literally exploded, and for two reasons. Number one, he couldn't believe what he was hearing, and number two, he was thinking like a taxpayer. This is my money. You know, yeah, this is our money, Canadians' money, that's being wasted or utilized for, you know, all the wrong reasons.
So I'm going to ask you about your situation when you refused to break the rules, even though you were essentially ordered to do so by the party leader and the party whip, and they punished you when you didn't. We'll do that in a bit. That's the story many of our listeners have heard you explain to us, and each time you do, I receive emails saying, basically, oh my God, it might as well start OMG, OMG, OMG. Now, can you tell us, though, how that nicely circumventing the rules discussion and the ethics and handling your expenses, how was that broached? What did they say? And who was saying it?
Well, specifically, you know, I was punished for posting expenses, and there was no rules against that. And in fact, I did have the permission of the party whip. And it was just, I was told I was making everybody look bad because they didn't want to do the same. Now, in terms of getting around rules, it was things like, for day one, you get a VIA rail pass that is good for the member to travel business class, like first class, as it were, anywhere that VIA goes. But then we were further told, now, see, what you can do is kind of cash it in and get two regulars so you can take your spouse along on a vacation.
and the
somehow that that just didn't make any sense.
No, isn't the theory, Michelle, behind those passes that you'd use them for business, government business?
Yeah, you know, if you had to go, or a lot of members, I know of one NDP member that actually replaced me in the election in 2011, and he didn't drive, so he would commute by train, and that's fair enough, you know, because he lived right by a VIA rail station in Scarborough, and he would take the train to Ottawa. So, you know, that's good. It's a lot cheaper than flying. But no, and it was, and they, you could take the vacation. All you maybe had to do was maybe call a member, one of your fellow members out in Vancouver, and say you're going to stop by. And so you can basically write it off as like a business. but that was nothing I dreamed up. That was something that was explained.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, I don't know why I'm laughing at this. I shouldn't be, but it's just so ludicrously unacceptable. So they would say to you, or you led to understand, that if you had a colleague, a fellow member of parliament in Vancouver, and you wanted to go to VC for vacation, you could cash in your business class ticket issued by the government to Michelle Simpson, member of parliament, and you could take the money, you could buy two economy tickets for you and your husband, and you could just boogie off to Vancouver, and then you could write it off because you'd said to this fellow member, we're coming to see you, whether you did or
we're
didn't.
We're going to visit the riding.
Oh, visit the riding. That's even better.
So, you know.
Oh, my goodness. So you'd go into a restaurant in the writing and you could write the dinner off.
That's right. Business. No, so, and that was literally explained. And that was, you know, only one example of, you know, how to get around things.
Was there anything else that you remember off the top of your head about what stood out?
Well, I had experience where, this is how I got into politics. I was the riding association president for a member, a liberal member, and that's how I got indoctrinated. And I remember what he said when it came time for giving his staff raises, which was, you know, once a year, that his preference was to give them performance bonuses that weren't outside the realm of anything. He was not extravagant, but his preference was performance bonuses as opposed to just throwing money. And that was something that I really believed in. If someone worked really hard, they were entitled to a little more money than, you know, the next guy. So I understood. I was explained to me when I was elected that they'd done away with that because I guess it was abused. So, but here's a way to get around it. You increase the staff member's salary a few months before the formal increase goes through. Like, give them a huge raise, which constitutes a bonus, and then you just drop back their salary a few months later.
Oh, my. So they had this thing wired. And that was just accepted behavior.
Absolutely. Because they were passing on the message.
Doesn't that remind you of the conversation you and I had with the British Member of Parliament when the... Remember when the Brits had a massive scandal a few years ago where members of the British Parliament had been spending their expense money on... Well, one guy spent it on building a moat around his castle. I mean, it was insane. And then when we spoke to the British MP, you and I, Michelle, he said, well, we had a caucus meeting, we had a party meeting, and we were told by the heads of the caucus, look, we understand that members of Parliament don't make enough money by our estimate, and we can't give you any more, so why don't you just use your expense account as additional salary? Just do with it whatever you want.
Well, if it was caucus leaders, this came from the bureaucrats themselves. You know, the people in finance.
It's insane.
These were not by the caucus. This was by actual bureaucrats.
Yeah.
Which makes it sadder.
Some of the British MPs, if I can recall correctly, and I can look this up, but some of the British MPs, as I remember, were facing criminal charges. And I wonder if
they
any...
were.
Yeah. I wonder if any of them ever wound up in as guests of Her Majesty's involuntary hotel.
That would be interesting to find out, but I remember they were going to be criminally charged because it was fraud.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
And, you know, if you build a moat around your castle, it's not going to be cheap.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, but I guess maybe he stopped before the drawbridge was put in. I don't know, but no. Oh, my goodness. Michelle, Florence just sent me an email about the British scandal, and it's Ed Balls and Yvette Cooper. I'll just read this to you. In September 2007, the married couple and Labour cabinet ministers Ed Balls, the Secretary of State for Children, Schools and Families, and Yvette Cooper, then the housing minister, used the Commons allowance system to pay for a $655,000 house in Stoke Newington, North London. The couple subsequently declared this to be their second home, despite spending most of the time in London in order to fulfill their ministerial responsibilities and their children attending London schools. The declaration of the Stoke Newington property as their second home meant they became eligible for a reported additional cost allowance of £44,000 a year to cover the property's $438,000 mortgage, The Conservative MP Malcolm Moss made a complaint to the Parliamentary Commission for Standards, who agreed to launch an investigation into the matter. The commissioner ultimately found the couple had acted in accordance with parliamentary rules and as such dismissed the complaint against them. The Committee on Standards and Privileges agreed with the commissioner's dismissal of the complaint. This is what you were talking about.
It's unbelievable that would be dismissed.
Yeah.
And you see, that's the problem. You know, you get coached and, you know, you go into it and you think, it won't happen to me. I know a lot of members have said this, but then I've seen what happens to them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's sort of everybody's doing it. It was like when I talked to the leader when I was on the carpet for having posted mine. And by the way, I posted it, started posting as soon as I was elected. The first year end was March 2009, so I posted, by the time I went through everything, it got posted by July, and that's when, you know, people took notice, but then it died down. Then what made it an issue was a lot of things coming to light in our parliament, people taking advantage with housing allowances, and so the spotlight was back on it, and that's when I became the bad guy.
And you were told, stop it.
Yes.
Stop it or else.
You have to stop. You have to stop. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, nor do I want to.
No.
I just don't. I, it's not me. So then the punishment came, and the punishment was in the form, and I know a lot of your listeners know this, that I was not allowed to speak in Parliament, and that's a big part of the job. I couldn't give a member statement. I couldn't ask a question. It was like I was on mute.
And you couldn't acknowledge the death of a Canadian soldier, one of your constituents, a young man, 21 years of age, in Afghanistan. You couldn't mention the death of a police officer who was run over by a maniac driving a snowplow.
That's right. It lived in my riding. And it was very, very hard for me. That was the biggest challenge. Because I like to acknowledge, and I before they silenced me, I was able to acknowledge a veteran that had arranged to get the poppies put on a few street signs in Scarborough. He'd worked hard for that. I got to acknowledge that. So I thought, what am I doing here? I'm a potted plant.
Mm-hmm. But if you'd gone along, they offered you a rather large office with a window looking out onto the Rideau Canal and your own bathroom.
Well, yeah, the own bathroom, because when I got my office, I thought, my God, there are families of four that live in less space than this. You know, I had a great size office. It was just given to me as one of the members, good view over the river. And I was in Confederation House, and it was great. So I didn't want a new office. I didn't even need the office I had.
Yeah, Michelle.
But there you go.
Thank you so much for sharing this with us again. And the coaching is frightening. And the situation in the UK, well, who knows?
I'm
that
sure
could be happening here.
Right?
Yeah. Thank you, Michelle.
It still goes on. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.